witches, fairies, superstition, folklore, and a feast of culinary delights. Who would have believed all of this could be found in the urban landscape of Briley Hill Church in the Black Country? This podcast takes you on a sunny May Day botanical walk, designed and led by Pam Smith of cited.org.uk. Pam has been funded by the Big Lottery via an organisation called OPAL, which stands for Open Air Laboratories. OPAL aims to get people engaged with nature through a multitude of activities, including the production of a botanical guidebook for Briley Hill. This is the starting point for Pam, as she and her audience of enthusiastic locals start the walk in front of the tower of St Michael's Church, Briley Hill.
Around Briley Hill, looking at some of the stories that I'll be telling you today. So it's trees and things, plants, weeds. Starts in Marsh Park, and there are two choices depending on how energetic you feel, and they go all the way down to the bottom of Delph Locks and sometimes back up again, and others go actually through to Merry Hill and look at the plants in the car parks at Merry Hill. So there's two choices. But what we're going to do is have a wander, and I'm just going to point out some of the things around the churchyard and some of the stories. But I want to set it in a bit of context first, because people talk about plant folklore and old remedies and things, and just the idea of, you know, where's it all come from. And if you think about, you know, probably 300-400 years ago, you know, that the idea of nature and seasons and plants was really significant. So what we see as folklore now was actually things that actually people did believe and how they rule their lives, because they needed luck and they needed to engage with nature and be very aware of things, and there was a lot of superstitions. So we'll find out a lot on this walk about witches and about fairies, and fairies actually are bad. There aren't many good fairies. It's only been Disneyfied in children's stories. Fairies and witches were basically as bad as each other. So there's a lot of superstition about bringing good luck to yourself, to the people you love, to your house, to your cattle, to your harvest. And really, you know, if people's harvest didn't come in, or their cattle, or they couldn't milk the cows, that was really significant. That was your livelihood, that's how you fed yourself. So anything that could help with that, the folklore and the stories, people obviously were going to give it a try. But there's a much more scientific side as well, in that some of these folklore stories, particularly to remedies, have been looked into, and there is, you know, there's something about it. So we, even today, about a third of our medicines are actually plant derived that we have now. So a third of the medicines on the NHS list of what you can be given by your doctor are actually from plants. Often what's happened in science is people have got the recipe from the plant, so it's like the blueprint, but then synthesize it and manufacture it, because they can guarantee the concentration and they can make much bigger quantities. But the original recipe came from the plant. Some drugs still actually include a lot of plant ingredients. Probably one of the best known ones is aspirin, and it's called aspirin, it's salicylic acid, and the botanical name for a willow tree, Salix. And it actually was, I mean, people found that it's a North American indigenous people actually scrape the bark and chew the bark and have a headache, and the acid that's in it is actually what's in aspirin. So some stories have come true. Now, the idea of, you probably, I don't know, when you go to garden centre and things, you see lots of plants and all the wonderful common names, but there's all these really confusing scientific names as well. They're not there to annoy people, they're not there to make botanists and everyone seem really more important than they are. It's actually real common sense, because even in one country like England, up and down the country, different areas call plants different names. Now, if you're trying to be a scientist and you've got a new remedy or a cure for cancer, you can't just go off common names, because, you know, not only can you not talk to colleagues in other countries, you can't even talk to colleagues at different universities in the same country, because people have different common names. So the botanical name is an agreed scientific name. People often think it's a Latin name. There's a lot of Latin words in there, but it also can use Greek names as well. So it tends to be a mixture. Now, if you're a true Latin scholar, you don't like plant Latin names, because it's a bit made up. You know, it's a bit like a pidgin English. It's not always true Latin. But a lot of the Latin names we got for plants actually come from the folklore stories. So if you translate back, you find out they've just translated what the folklore name was into Latin. So it's not from, or it may just be a description. It may mean yellow bark, big leaf, heart-shaped leaf. That's all it is. It's just a description. And the main person who did it was someone called Linnaeus, a Swedish botanist, and he gave us all these parts of plants, and Homo sapiens, and then the fossils and everything. So all plant life was mapped, and it was almost like decimalisation. It put things in a system and in an order and made them easier to look at and compare against each other. So a lot of the plants are to do with that. But what people in particular believed before Linnaeus came along, this wonderful thing called Doctrine of Signatures, and it was to do with God and how all the plants in the world started in the Garden of Eden, and after the Great Flood, all the plants scattered to all corners of the world. But originally, all the plants that existed in the world were in the Garden of Eden. And the idea of Doctrine of Signatures was, if we know about a plant's qualities and we know how good they are, God must have given us a clue. So somewhere in the plant is a clue about what you use it for. Now, some are really obvious. Let's have a look. Got a few props in my pocket, hold on. Walnut. Right. Walnut is good for brains, headaches, memory, because it looks like a brain. You know, even more so when you actually take the nut out. So that's the idea. It was very literal, and it was very, and again, we've translated some of those into the Latin name. The name for the walnut, lots of people associate it with walls, but it actually comes from an Anglo-Saxon word, weald, which is, I think, W-E-A-L-D, and it means foreign. So it's actually foreign nut, and that's because it comes from Persia. It was thought to be introduced by the Romans, so it's not a native tree, but it's been here a long time. So some of these things that we forget and people associate with walls. There is a lot of stories about beating walnuts, and you can beat your wife, your dog, and your walnut tree. And apparently the nuts taste better if you beat the tree and they fall off rather than you pick them. But so this is one example of Doctrine of Signatures. Another one is the cyclamen was thought to be good for heartburn and heartache. And think of a cyclamen leaf, it's a bit of a heart shape, isn't it? You get a little viola called Heartsease, look at the leaf. So there's lots of things like that. So Doctrine of Signatures wasn't very scientific. And if you said that plant is good for the heart, what the leaf might be heart shaped, the flower might be lung shaped, the roots might be leg shaped. It was very subjective, you know, what bit of the plant were you looking at? So obviously when Linnaeus came along, they thought, hang on a minute, this just doesn't work. So we've gone from quite a religious side in terms of looking at the messages that were imprinted on plants through to the scientific, but all the way through this folklore has carried on. So what we're going to do is take a walk, we'll do a big loop around the churchyard, and just I'll point out some plants along the way, and we'll talk about it. If you've got any questions, please ask along the way, and then hopefully it'll inspire you that when the booklet's out, to do the big walk. Trees that you have, there's some along here and there's one here. This is the common lime. It's actually a cross between two different lime trees, and it's the one you see most often. And the easy way to tell the common one is it always gets those little shoots at the bottom, and they're a pair of street trees. They're the ones the council have to prune all the time because they block your vision. The lime trees, I mean, it's like everything's just starting to come out now. They said one of the worst ones to park your car under the summer because the aphids and the stickiness. And what it is the excrement from the aphids. It's called honeydew, which is quite a nice phrase really for it, isn't it? And so that's what, so lime trees are really popular with aphids. They really like them. And all the honeydew actually goes black on the leaves. And that's not dirt in the air. A lot of people think the leaves are sticky and the dirt in the air is stuck to them. What it actually is another fungus. So there's two things there. There's the honeydew and there's a fungus that lives off the honeydew, and that makes that black sootiness on the leaves. But these aren't ideal. These aren't ideal for parking under, but they were really good avenue trees. They tend to be quite equal. They clone really well, so a lot of National Trust avenues are lime trees because you can take cuttings and clone them and you get a very uniform shape. The European lime, which is one of the parents of this one, one of the cross, is better because you don't get all the suckers at the bottom, so you haven't got that spoiling the shape or the maintenance. It makes a really nice honey. Lime flower honey is a really, really nice honey. It's a lot cleaner and fresher. It's not as sweet as normal honey, so it's very popular with beekeepers as well. And we just look at here. If we look at a lot of the symbolism in the church, you can see the rose on there, that grave in here. There's a lot of plants where this folklore and symbolism has carried on in paintings and books or carvings, even if the plant, you don't really know what it is, eventually it gets stylized. But a lot of the reasons for them being done was very symbolic. So originally they were quite accurate, but then we get used to the pattern and it gets more and more blurred and we forget the actual meaning. Roses are really common to see in carving. Obviously this is great, Briar Hill, it's named after the Briar Rose. Briar Rose is one of the wild roses. And if you look at roses and look at rose thorns on wild roses, they all point backwards. When you see lots of drawings of roses, people do them outwards or upwards. They all point backwards and they're there to stop animals eating them. That's an obvious reason why plants have thorns. But they're actually there to help them climb their little hooks like that so they can scramble over things. So all the wild roses, all the rose thorns point backwards. In terms of symbolism, the rose goes back a long, long time in history. There are roses all over the world in terms of native plants. Obviously here, we've got the best stories about plants that are British natives because they've been here the longest. You know, people built, and they were here when it was, you know, when it was important to be in touch with nature. So they tend to all be about mainly British plants or ones that have been here since the 400, 500 time. So, but roses, there's lots of British native roses. Now, the reason you get lots of carvings, let's think, there's a few things. I don't know if any of you've got them at home, ceiling roses around your light in the middle of the plasterer. Usually, might not have a picture of a rose on it anymore, may just be a pattern. The whole thing comes from Greek and Roman wars, and the idea was when you met at your camp and you met secretly with messengers and various people, you met under a rose, and anything said under a rose is secret. It's like you'd say between these four walls. And there's an old boardroom term called sub rosa, and some old, yeah, although I said this is sub rosa, it means under the rose. So it basically means whatever's been said here is just for your, you know, your ears only, between these four walls. And so eventually, you know, people can't always have everything under a rose. So eventually what they did in ceilings of boardrooms and meeting rooms and main rooms, they carved a rose in the ceiling. So you were always meeting under the rose. And eventually, dilutions, we just remember ceiling rose. We could go to home base and buy one and might not even have a rose on it. But if you look, if you go to a lot, like next time you're in a big house, like National Trust House, particularly in places like this, some of the big rooms, like the parlour and the drawing room, often the plasterwork is roses because it comes from that sub rosa and that super. Pardon? Can you? Yeah. The roses on the top. Yeah. So again, there's these things, it is pretty, and you think, why not carve a rose? It's a really pretty flower, but it comes from those stories. The other way is the rosary beads. Now, rose flavour and rose water is used, it's in Turkish delight, people use rose water as a perfume, but rose petals dried and ground up, made into balls, were the original rosary beads. So it was roses, so we've got into rosary beads. So sometimes, a bit like I was saying about the botanical names, and the folklore names, you hear a word and it just goes in, and it's only when you start to dissect the word and think, oh yeah, what does that mean? So there's lots of things to do with roses dotted around, and it is one of the ones that you will get carved in churches. There's quite a lot of plants that are, because of old pagan belief and things, that aren't carved in churches. One in particular is mistletoe. There's only one church in Britain that's actually got a mistletoe carved in it. Roses are quite common. There's lots of stories about the white rose turning pink when the Virgin Mary touched it. The blood of Christ was on the thorns, so that turns the rose hips red. And so lots of associations, so it gets embedded into the culture. So we're going to wander down the hill here. I don't think it's too slippy, but watch your footings. Because that 1st of May is really associated with the start of spring and lots of folklore, and you know, hopefully, because I've just put all my plants out, no more frosts in this part of the world, we'll see. So it's quite a good timing for a folklore walk, really. And really, the start, people talk about plants and the start of spring, and people talk about climate change and things changing and seasons getting different. But one sign for spring is if you can put your foot on 12 daisies, that means spring has started. Now I've got size 7s and we're in quite a good spot. I think, I don't know, almost, not quite. The daisy is really well known and you get it a lot in children's stories and folks. So really, and it means day's eyes because the daisy opens and closes. So it closes at night. So if you come out in the evening, they all close. So that's why it's called day's eyes, because it opens up. another one, we've got one there, the dandelion. Now, what do people associate dandelions with?
Wet in the bed.
Wet in the bed, there we are. But now's your chance. I'm sure a lot of us need it. But 1st of May, if you let your children smell a dandelion, they won't wet the bed for the year. So we got this. So and the story about eating them is one of the things. It was really popular, particularly like fruits, first, second world war, just after second world war, roasting the roots of dandelion as a coffee substitute. And you can still, if you go in health food shops, they often have dandelion coffee there. I've tried it. It tastes like bad coffee. Just, you know, like sometimes some coffee is just a bit too bitter. Lots of plants. Think about here now. Well, nice lush grass. We've got plants and grass. This was important. If you were trying to graze your animals and this is how you fed yourself and this was your income, you needed nice lush pasture. So plants associated with nice green grass often had the nice stories. And in particular things like dandelion, sow thistle, things that when you cut them, they have a milky sap running out. Well, that was like nectar and milk. So the idea that you give dandelion leaves to young calves helps them develop immunity and all sorts of things. So it's just the appearance, really. It means if you've got loads of dandelions, you might have some good pasture. It's got a milky sapping, so people associate that with young animals. So it's just these little associations. Now, if you haven't got much grazing, but you can pick a load of dandelion leaves, like people do for the rabbit in the hutch, then obviously that is good for your animals as well, because you're feeding them, aren't you? You're giving them green material. So there's a lot of logic in these. There isn't anything superstitious. It just seems a logical thing to do, that you've got nice green things to feed the animals. Another weed here is this one. Yep, broadleaf plantain. We've got them both here. We've got the long one and the broadleaf. This one gets really big, and it's the one with the flower heads on, which I know when I was a kid you loop the stalk over and you flick it and you pull them all off. Broadleaf plantain is also known as white man's footprint. And this is because it was introduced particularly to North America by people going over, and often plants are stairways and they've taken the seeds with them. And the idea, what they said was, wherever an Englishman tread, plantain appeared. So it's white man's foot. You can eat this. What you can do, this isn't quite big enough yet, the ribs on the back, the veins are quite tough. But if you get one, I mean, it's what I do with spinach sometimes, with big leaves, you can actually peel the back stalk off and take the worst out. It's quite bitter though. So a lot of plants that you can eat because they won't kill you, but with choice now that we have, they probably, you would think, oh, I'd rather have rocket, or I'd rather have a nice bird lettuce, or, but you know, these were important for people to eat. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of plants that you wouldn't choose to eat now, but formed an important part of people's diets. If we think of rosebay willow herb that we associate as an herb, you can eat that, the young shoots that like asparagus. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a few plants, even, which hopefully we'll have to eat quite a lot of it, Japanese knotweed. Mm-hmm. So, if we're all very hungry, we may be able to control the Japanese knotweed problem. what we think now in terms of this is like asparagus, we're comparing it to an asparagus that has been bred and cultivated to be not too bitter, just right. So the wild, you know, if it was a wild asparagus, we probably wouldn't notice a difference, but we're comparing things now that have been done for our palate. So a lot of things, a lot of wild plants, things probably would taste a bit tougher. The texture's hairy leaves, not really used to having things with hairy leaves, and the bitterness as well. But some things I've cooked, the broadleaf plantain, like spinach, and actually that was quite nice. It is slightly bitter, more bitter. It doesn't fall apart as much as spinach, but you would use it as you would spinach. So, and there's loads of it. The problem is with picking anything on the ground is making sure no one's weed on it. So when you pick blackberries and things, people say don't pick them up leg high, don't they? Pick them a bit higher up. Right, we'll head down just to the bottom corner here. You can see the horse chestnuts that have been cut back, just coming into leaf, all the leaves hanging down. Now, there's the actual chestnut is poisonous for people. Some animals can eat it. The story behind the horse chestnut name may be, I mean, obviously there's the sweet chestnut, which are the chestnuts you buy, the roasted chestnuts, which isn't a British native tree, is next time you near a horse chestnut, have a look at what's called the leaf star. Now, all deciduous trees, the leaves fall off and they leave a scar. And the leaf star on horse chestnuts is really, really obvious. And it's a little triangle with dots on and it looks like a horseshoe. So it could be because of that. So next time you near a horse chestnut, it won't go down because it's a bit rough there, but if you wanted to have a look, you can just about see it on the younger ones. Some that's really obvious on are things like the tree of heaven and things. If you look at those, because they have such big leaves, all it is the vessels, a bit like celery. You know, the big stringy bits in celery, they're just leaf vessels, but you can see them really big. Whereas small leaves, like lime trees, they're there, but you can't see them with your eye. Horse chestnuts are a little bit bigger, so you can see them, so you see those dots. Tree of heaven and things like that are really big ones, so you can see them even more obviously, and it's just the strings like you get inside celery, those vessels that are moving water and food around. Now, one of the plants here, elder, there's some over there just coming into leaf. Really shrubby. They get quite big, but they're not what you could call a tree. You know, they don't usually have one trunk. I mean, there's loads of bits. These are really associated with witches. Witches live in these, and you have to have permission. It's really superstitious. You're not meant to chop down elder trees. There's lots of trees and shrubs associated with ask permission before you chop them down, but, you know, who are you asking permission for? What answer will you get? Is it just a courtesy of asking and then doing it? But elder and hawthorn are some of the main ones. There's even a story, I haven't been able to find it was true, but Belfast University, when they were extending their university in the 50s, actually changed the plans so they didn't have to chop down a hawthorn tree. And a friend who works at Glasnevin Botanic Garden in Dublin has said about them actually doing roads that don't mean moving certain rocks because they've got associations with fairies and things. So, some of the stories. The thing is, with the plant folklore, we're lucky at the moment because it's still not that long away in terms of a generation. We have people alive now who their parents and grandparents have told them the stories, whereas we won't have that for much longer because our brains rule things out. Like, silly, who'd have thought of that? You know, but we've still got people, so you can still, in a lot of plant folklore books, people have interviewed, you know, people in the, you know, 1970s, 1980s, it's, oh yeah, my dad told me this. We've still got it, but we're going to lose it because in a way we've lost that romanticism and that need to know about nature so much. That need to, you know, we do rely on it, but that need to appear to rely on it, that we've got to do things that bring good luck. Elder is brilliant. It's one of my favourites. Let's say it's associated with witches. The name elder, the common name, its botanical name is Sambucus. The common name elder actually again comes from an Anglo-Saxon word, ailed, A-E-L-D, and it means fire. And that's because the stems are hollow, they've got a real pithy sort of centre to them, a bit like a reed, I don't know if you cut reeds, like foam in the middle. And they were used to start a fire, because it's nice and dry and easy, it cuts easily. The elder sticks are really good. I don't know if any of you ride horses, possibly not, any of you ride bikes, maybe. Stops you getting a sore bum. I don't know how this works, because I would have thought if you put two elder twigs in your back pockets, how that would help you better, but apparently it works, and lots of people swear. And there's still old stories in cycling books and stuff from the 50s about putting elder. Eventually it gets down to being an elder leaf, which I'm sure is a lot more comfortable. We've missed an opportunity, but the last day of April, so yesterday, so we're probably a bit late, you pick a leaf, eat a leaf of elder, and it gives you good luck and good health for the rest of the year. One of the other ones which we can wait for, I don't know if there's any oak trees here, but Midsummer's Day, if you've got an oak tree near you, so Midsummer's Day, hug an oak tree. I know lots of people go on about hugging trees, but this is Midsummer's Day only. Don't do it the whole year round, people think you're mad. Only on one day you can get away with it. And that brings you good luck for the rest of the year as well. And I did this at a talk at a botanic garden with a group about the same size. And as we walked past, there's loads of people just going, touching the tree. So it was on Midsummer's Day, you see. You see people just sort of go, like that. The other thing, while I'm talking about oak trees, we've got lots of plants associated with lightning. Elder keeps witches away. You have elder storks. Jake, wait a minute. You have elder storks leant against your door. You put elder leaves above your stable. Keeps everyone away. The other one that does is your... where is it? In here. Oak. Now, don't you think that if superstition, people's houses didn't get struck by lightning when they had an oak tree next door? Now, the reason is the oak tree's bigger than your house, so the lightning. But people thought, no, the oak tree's special, it wards off lightning. Eventually, when people moved into towns and cities, not everyone could live near an oak tree. Lots of stories about oak trees because they were British native. Things that are really impressive on the landscape, like an oak tree would be, you know, bigger than any building that a lot of people had seen. had lots of, you know, the acorns you could feed to animals, so they had lots of uses for shelter, all sorts of things. So very important sort of thing. So people thought, oh, we knew an oak tree, that got struck by lightning, our house is safe. Eventually, people didn't have an oak tree planted near them because they lived in a village or whatever. So they collected acorns and put them on a bit of string and hung them in the window because the magic is still there. And what we end up with now is your light pole, which is acorn.
Oh, yes. Oh.
On window blinds and your bathroom light. I mean, obviously they've changed in shape, but that is the, when you look, they're all based on that shape and some are still acorn shape. So we've carried that on without knowing. You know, now you can get them. I bought these off eBay, I think. So, but, you know, but it comes from the fact that people used to live in a countryside with big oak trees. Yeah, you know, and all the stories about, so, you know, how you keep the lightning away. Because, again, it was something important. You know, like, you know, living in a big area, you probably, I don't know, you know, it's not saying that there's more or less lightning now, but things like that could have a big impact on you, more so. I mean, now we've got lightning conductors on buildings, and we've got, so things that you thought you need to really fight off this nature, because it's hard work living with nature. And if anything goes wrong, it has a big effect on us. So there's lots of things to do with the lightning. The witches, on the other hand, usually, well, most of the time, actually, the witches weren't that brilliant. There was a story that someone, and this was in the 1940s in Shropshire, that a man and his son were, he chopped down a piece of elder branch to give to his son because he could use as pea shooters as well, because they're hollow on the inside. Now, they did this, they chopped a bit off, and they thought the tree bled a bit. It's been a bit weird. Walking down the lane, there was a woman who was known as the local witch, and when they went past, she had a bandage on her arm with a new fresh cut on it. So the idea was that witches were actually elder trees over time. But the thing is, I don't know, the distinctive thing about elders, it's got quite craggy bark. The new stems have very definite dots on them. They're called lenticels, really obvious dots, and they absolutely stink. If you want to pass some of these leaves around, I can smell it now, just moving, can't you? I don't know if you've ever smelt an elder, but you won't again after this. If you've passed some of those, there's a bit there. Okay. Show that. Oh, I've got one leaf left, if you want to. If you rub it together, it's pretty strong, isn't it? What did you think, Jake? Horrible. So, witches. Any plant associated with witches, you could probably guess, is not going to smell that nice. So it's probably the smell that led to the evil idea and things hiding in it. Well, it's just, it's because of, yeah, but it's the bitterness and... it's not perfect, but it makes amazing. Just think about all the things you can make: elderflower cordial, elderflower champagne, and then you've got the elderberries. So it's, you know, it might not be the most attractive plant, but if you've got room somewhere or you know of some nearby, then use it. And the botanical guidebook points out some elders along the way, and it's got recipes for elderflower cordial as well. And it's really, you like it, don't you? It's really easy to make. We make it every year, don't we? It doesn't keep very long, so you can make it and put some in your freezer if you want to keep it. And I spent ages trying to work out, I was reading the ones you buy in the supermarket, so, well, what do they put in that I don't? But it's because it's been sort of pasteurised rather than any sort of chemical preserve. But then I was thinking, why am I getting worried about this? Because isn't it about being seasonal? So actually, shouldn't it just be you enjoy it at this time of year, and it's not the end of the world if you can't have it at Christmas? But it is, so I find myself even thinking, but I want it all year round. You think, no, that's the point, we're not meant to have things all year round.
I tried making an elderflower champagne once.
Did it explode?
And I thought, I've got this big tub, and I made gas from it, left it in the cellar. As long as it said, I went to filter it or to strain it. I got my strainer with the bucket, and I got the, and it just fell out in one blob.
Oh, did it? So it was more of an elderflower jelly then, really, wasn't it?
I made elderflower jelly.
Yeah. Because the elderflower, you can make elderflower champagne, which isn't the alcoholic one, it's just fizzy, and you put white in it. Yeah, but then there's an alcoholic one that, but you're best to use a proper yeast, a champagne yeast. The elderberries are quite, they're amazing looking, but they are quite insipid, a bit like rowan trees. You have to, if you make jam and things, you have to put quite a lot with them. But this year.
Last year with the elderberries.
Yeah, did you?
Yeah, I did.
What was it? Did you put anything else with it, like apple or anything?
I put some apple in.
Yeah.
Instead to raise the pectin level.
Yeah.
Put a bit of apple in.
What was it like? like then?
I made it too sweet.
All right, that's the thing. Because when you're so prepared for like a need loads of sugar, you probably overcompensate,
yeah,
don't you?
So, but I mean, it was edible, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I made this year, I did, because the elderberries just looked so luscious. There's loads of them, they're such a dark colour. Yeah. I was determined to use them. So what I did was I made slow and elderberry gin.
Ah.
So I thought that was all right. And then I put, as I bottled it, I put a piece of cinnamon in. So it's really nice, actually. I've been giving away it as presents at Christmas. I'm on to the last bit now. I wrote about that much. So elder's great. And if you've got room for an elder or you know of some, you only need about 5 flowers to make about 1.5 litres of cordial. And obviously you're diluting that when you use it. So it's very easy. So I would recommend it.
I must have had half a tree in mine.
Oh, well. Well, you put half a tree in, you get half a tree out, don't you, really? And the easy way, because I don't know if you remember, like canned parsley flowers, very big. There's hundreds of flowers on one flower, as it were. Big flower. The easiest way is to pick the flower stalks, your little whole umbrella, and use a fork and just do that and comb it with a fork, because it's the stems that are bitter. So the fewer stems you've got in, the better it is. For the elder flower, the same. Yeah, the flower heads, just to do. But you do need quite a lot of sugar. I've made it with stools, and it's great because you get them to be adventurous and taste things that they wouldn't normally taste, which when they've made it, they're quite keen to do it when the classmates are having a go. And it's usually about 50-50, you know, if people like it or not. And often it's, oh, but miss, there was bugs in that. And so, yeah, but they've been in hot water and it was 5 days ago, they'll be fine, and we filter it all. But yeah, actually doing the flower heads is the best bit. It goes all over the place, but that's the best bit. But then you're aware that you're putting about 2 pounds of sugar in, and you think you're talking about, you know, tasting new things and how you should be ambitious, and then you're giving them 2 pounds of sugar. Yes, honey.
You did it at my school.
I did do it at your school, yeah. It was good, wasn't it? I'm doing it again. So elder, I think, is great value. Not pretty. You can get an ornamental one, a black one, really dark purple leaves. The flowers are slightly pinky. You can use it the same way. You don't get as many flowers on those as you do the wild ones, because it's been bred for the coloured leaves, so you often lose the flower. But given that you only need about five flowers, then the pinkiness doesn't come out. I was hoping it would change the colour a bit, but it gets lost. Around here as well, so we've got all the trees, got lots of sycamore and things coming up, really self-seed. It's ones that ecologists, people don't like because they're very invasive, they self-seed everywhere. Because they're not a British native, the association is that we don't have native birds and insects, but they've been here such a long time that really they're having, in some cases, the sycamore woods are, you know, really successful woodlands, but they are very invasive. You can see them coming up everywhere. Now we're going to wander up the hill and just to the corner there where the big laurel is on the fence. Mast, so it's all the bits that fall on the floor, lots of beech nuts, but usually the nuts inside aren't really big enough to, you know, that you'd have to get a lot of them to actually get some sort of flavour. But the other thing is, which here, beech leaves, dried beech leaves were used to stuff mattresses. And in France, beds that are stuffed with beech leaves are called lit parlement, which means talking beds, because they rustle when you get in. Dried leaves, think that they're still here now, it's May, they're still here. You know, dried leaves, they're naturally insect proof, they've dried, they've got a lot of tannin in, they've got lots of natural insecticides in, perfect for a mattress. I don't know how you just put a lot in, I'm not sure how comfortable it would be, but that's all the noise. Here, the laurel. Evergreen, the difference between evergreen deciduous plants, the first one is obviously the deciduous ones are losing their leaves in the winter because they can't cope with the cold and the freezing of the leaves and the damage in the cells. If you're an evergreen plant, you need to get round this. All the evergreen plants you can think of, they're glossy, they're shiny, they're tough, they're thicker. Compare it to like the lime trees and things, you know, they're much tougher leaves. It's almost like they've been coated in a varnish. That is their coat, it protects them. The other thing is something called stomata. We know, you know about plants, they take in carbon dioxide, they take it in and take it out because they've got holes in the leaves. Now if you have loads of holes on the top with the sun on, it evaporates like having a wet sponge. If you have the sun on it, it'll dry. So most of the holes on the leaf are underneath. So they can still do that action of the gas going in and out, but they haven't got the heat of the sun getting in and drying up the cells. Now, if you're trying to protect yourself and it's cold and frosty, And often it's drought. We think about winter and think about wet. Frozen soil is no water for the plants. That's why plants wilt in the winter. When it's cold, you'll see the leaves wilting because it's just the same as being bone dry. If the water isn't in a liquid form, they can extract. So it's either not there at all because it's the summer, or it's there but it's frozen. So they need to be really tough and manage. So if we had a big magnifying glass, a microscope, we'd be able to see that all the stomata on the leaf on a laurel, you talk about, let's say, I only know it in square inches, so we'll do inches. If you look at that lime tree or a beech tree, you're talking a few hundred dots, a few hundred holes per square inch. Talk about an evergreen tree like this, you're talking in the thousands. So they're much more protected, they're much tougher. Now, laurel, I don't think we can...
You want a magnifying glass?
No, I don't know if we'll be able to see. Let's have a go. I think we need something even more. No one's got an electron microscope in their pocket. No, I don't think we'll be able to see. Laurel. Lots of people see it. It's cherry laurel, you know, the black berries that make mess all over the pavements. Really good hedging plant, really tough. Things don't eat it. It's actually really poisonous. It's got, you know, when you watch Agatha Christie and Miss Marple, arsenic poison, smells of almonds. That's what you say, like Sherlock Holmes, smells of almonds. Well, it's the same arsenic here, and this is almonds, and people used to use it as a cheap almond substitute. So people used it in milk puddings and... And it's actually really poisonous. So it depends. You know, when they say a lot of it, like Culpepper's Herbal, say it's deadly in large quantities, it's what's a large quantity? So in most cases, if you ate so many, you'd be sick before it actually got into your system too much. But I was, when I went to the Botanic Garden, I was doing a talk and said about the laurel, and there was a lady there who was in her sort of early 70s, and she remembered, she was smiling, she remembered her grandmother sending her to bed with a laurel leaf and a glass of hot milk. And so that's in these stories. And people did, they used to, like, so make custard and milk pudding with a laurel leaf because almonds was too expensive. And there is a case, I think it's about the mid-1700s, of a whole wedding party in Ireland being seriously ill and killed by the cook using laurel leaves because they're trying to do a cheaper wedding buffet and use laurel leaves as the flavouring. So there's actually a lot of plants that are poisonous. People have said, I mean, one of the best ones, Foxglove, you know, that's the flower for Birmingham, the emblem for Birmingham in terms of the county flowers. But it is really poisonous and people panic about that, but actually we've got much, much more poisonous. In terms of the ones that children get sent to hospital with poison plants, this is in the top ones, laburnum, wisteria. It's the same thing because it's the pods, it's the seeds are really, really... So it's the same as laburnum and wisteria, if you think, very similar, aren't they? The pods, black seeds, it's all leguminosa, the pea family, it's got pods, and yeah, they're the main ones. But people forget, you know, and really it's a lot of things, it's common sense, isn't it? You don't go around eating lots of things you don't know what they are, really. So we'll head up here. This one you can eat, hawthorn. If you want to pick a leaf. Bread and cheese. Hawthorn's known as bread and cheese. Eat the flowers. I think the flowers are meant to be the cheese because of the colour. I don't know. But the leaves are the bread, the flowers are the cheese. British native. Lots of stories. It's May Day. Well, its common name is the May Tree. Mm. Now, this was fine until, in theory, it was always flowering on the 1st of May, but then the calendar changes in the mid-1700s. It's knocked everything back. The other big issue with a lot of hawthorn that's planted on, for example, highway verges and things, a lot of that is from Holland. You know, our British nursery industry, land is so expensive that it's very hard to have good growing. You know, if you think you've got to grow a tree for 5 or 6 years before you sell it, the cost of land in Britain, so you can't compete with some other countries. But a lot of plants come over from Holland and Italy, and they're set back anyway. The flowering, and it's a big issue because they're flowering at the wrong time for the butterfly eggs and the knock-on effect. If the butterflies are ready to lay their eggs on the hawthorn and they need the flowers and the net and they aren't flowering for another 2 weeks, everything's slightly out of sync. But mainly because the calendar changes. The thing on the 1st of May, hang hawthorn boughs above your door, feed them to cattle, again, all those stories. This is very good luck. Everything is great as long as you leave it over your door, against the door. Don't take it inside, it's associated with death. The main reason we think is the smell of it is a particular chemical and it's the same chemical that dead flesh, rotting flesh lives off. It's the same chemical, and they think this comes from the Great Plague, when people were very used to the smell of death. The last thing they wanted was a plant in the house that reminded them of that smell. So then you get that superstition of hawthorn in the house, someone's going to die, you know. That, so it's a logical story somewhere along the line, we think. Right. Head up to the top.
Something Laurel and Bay.
Ah, well, it's the confusion of the naming. Laurel is what we call, that's the common name for that. It's called Prunus Lusitanica. The name for Bay is Laurus Nobilis. So we have, through Chinese whispers, given the name of Bay to that. So a lot of stories like the Romans and the Bay, and the wreath of laurel, it actually should be bay leaves. But when you see the motor races and Grand Prix, they have laurel, and they use laurel leaves. So
when you're cooking with bay leaves, you're cooking with laurel.
No, you're cooking with bay. Yeah, you're cooking with bay, but because the botanical name for bay is Laurus nobilis, noble. It was a very important Roman plant, and we call that laurel because it's big evergreen leaves. Somewhere along the line, we'd pinch the name. So the common name for that for laurel, the botanical name for bay is Laurus. So, yeah, don't cook with those.
Tell the difference.
Pardon? Totally different plants, different species. These are Prunus, so these are like the plums and, you know, the sort of Prunus family. So there's lots of more other sorts of laurel. There's a really nice Portuguese one that's a lot finer with red stems. So, yeah, we've carried on names and then they get adopted. And that's the thing I was saying at the beginning about Latin. You know, it's not true Latin because people have put us on the end and altered it. And if you want to name a plant after someone, you put double I on the end. So Buddleia Davidi, Buddleia, the butterfly bush, is named after a botanist called David, and it's Davidi. So it's made up, you know. A lot of the Latin is descriptive, like yellow flowers, heart-shaped leaves, but a lot of it is with added letters and things on the end. So a true Latin scholar would say it's a load of rubbish. Yeah.
Have we got tread on?
12. Do it here, hang on. I can do it here. It's cheating. I think it's cheating if you've got to look, isn't it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
So, hey,
that's
12.
I can do that. In fact, I can do about
15. There you go.
Oh, yeah, so it's officially, it's right, ready for the hot weather now. Can you do 12?
Yeah.
Squashing them all. There's a few plants I wanted to point out from here. You probably know the birch tree. Quite small, again, a British native, and it's known as a colonizer. So if you think of people who arrive somewhere first, and birches, you'll see them on railway lines and heathland. You know, people talk about preserving heathland, because eventually heathland would turn into an oak forest. And one of the stages would be birch trees. They're the first ones to arrive and get established. And you'll see, as I say, if you're on a tray, you'll notice loads of buttleia, but lots of birch trees, because they're the ones who can survive the gravel, and they're the first ones in. So it's a coloniser. It's a British native, but it's a European native. Lots of northern Europe. In Scandinavian countries, it's one of the trees that's associated with the tree of life. And one of the ideas is when you get the, it's not as obvious on the young ones, but you know, when you get the nice white tree trunk, and obviously a lot of the ones you have in your garden have been bred to be as white as possible. The native one is white, but not as white, but it has lots of black sort of scars on it, lots of black patches. Mm-hmm. The souls of your ancestors reside in the black patches. It's the tree of life.
We were just talking about that, because when I walk around, I always think about trees feed off the people that are buried here.
Yeah.
Because I always think that, and they like, when it's all quiet, you can hear it's like talking.
Yes, the whispers.
I always think,
Yeah, well, one of the things about yews and churchyard is that one of the things is that all the roots connect to each grave, and it's like the living sort of thing. So, yeah, but there's lots of trees, because again, it's that whole thing of trees. Imagine how impressive, and they're impressive now, but imagine when you don't have big buildings and you don't have, or you know, you're living in a little village somewhere, you're not getting very far. Trees must have been amazing. And any plants, like the evergreen plants, any plants at Christmas that are still green when it's cold and dark, and especially if you've got flowers or fruit on, it's like, God, that's amazing. How is it doing it? It must be magical. So there's lots of things. So you can see that people want that continuity of ancestry and you know, life after death.
Tree hugging.
Well,
Because I know a lot of people who do tree hugging. So it must be something to do.
Well, it's probably there aren't many plants you can probably hug, are there? So I suppose a tree, yeah. And it's that link with the past. You know, it's a link with the past because, you know, big tree, you know, 150, 200, 400 years, you know, there's not many links with the past that you've got, and it is a living thing. You should try it on a eucalyptus. There's probably loads of eucalyptus, right? You know, a lot of eucalyptus in the garden. You can hear the water moving up a eucalyptus. So don't hug it, put your ear to it. And on a summer's day, you can hear it. Sometimes it's called a singing tree, but you can hear it. If you get a little glass, like a shot glass or something small, but you can't hear it with your ear on a hot day. The water's going up so much. An oak tree on a hot day would 400 pints go up on one day. So, you know, there's a lot of water movement. So the birch trees are quite significant. The big old birch trees have witches' brooms in. You can see all that cray. Sometimes you think it's a nest, and it isn't. It's almost like a little mutation in the branch, and it grows lots and lots of little ones. And so it is associated with witches. And again, keeping these terrible witches, who obviously, apart from living in an elder tree, want to be in your house all the time. So you often have birch houses. And one thing was you get these witches' brooms, so these craggy bits and all the little spindly bits of shoots, cut it off and stick it upside down at your door. It keeps the witches away, but also it's a boot cleaner because you clean your boots on it.
No, not that.
That's a proper boot cleaner. That would work a lot better than a birch tree. The plant underneath, I'll just pick a leaf. Silverweed, cinquefoil, French five leaves. Botanical name is potentilla. Now you get garden plants, little yellow flowers, potentilla. This is a wild one. Even though you got one name, potentilla, that's a genus, and there could be 50, 100 plants in that name. Potentilla, this comes from the fact it's the powerful one, potent. Really, really powerful. Now, this is what one of the ingredients that witches use to make them fly. Don't think that'll work. It is also really good. A tea made out of potentilla is apparently meant to wash away scars. And there's lots of things to do with plants about getting rid of frettles. And I've got loads of frettles. But people are obsessed with, like, because they thought saw it as a sign of bad health. So there's lots of plants, rosemary, pink foil that you're meant to wash and soothe. There's lots of terrible things that, you know, where it says take one owl. And you think, no, I'm not going to, you know. But I was reading one last night that was take an owl, pluck it and take out her guts. And I was thinking, I don't even know what this is for, but I won't read anymore. So we're pretty horrific. We're going to just cut through the land there. There's a few plants on this bit, some of the main churchyard ones I want to talk about. Right, we've got quite a lot of bluebells around here. I know quite a lot of places are doing bluebell walks today, so it's quite a relief that they are opening in time. Bluebells, the sap is very, if you cut up the bulb or even in the leaves, it's got a very, very sort of sticky sap. It was used as a glue to put feathers on arrowheads. So it was used quite a lot as an actual glue. And you think, it's not just about medicine and eating, it's about using plants. So using elder to make fires or bulrushes to make candle tallows and all sorts of things. So it's about the use as well to have, you know, be a lot more practical and use day-to-day things. You didn't go out and buy everything, you use things that are around. And those uses are right. You know, elder is good to start a fire. It does make good pea shooters and elder fire champagne. Elderflower sorbet is good as well. It's bluebell leaf.
Bluebell?
Yeah. So there's a lot here. There's a big issue with bluebells. You've heard about all the problems with Spanish bluebells. They're hybridising. So a lot of the ones you buy in garden centres, and you have done for quite a long time, it's getting better now, were Spanish because they were easier, they were a bit more showy. And they had flowers all the way around. Bluebells hang like that. Spanish ones are all the way around. So the hybrid ones now are a mixture. So they're not quite all the way around, but they're not quite on one side. And that's a problem that once you release these into nature, you can't stop pollen and bees and everything spreading. So bluebells are protected. The wild bluebells are protective species. Holly, smooth leaves, spiky leaves. Christmas, we all have holly at Christmas. Again, what I was saying about how amazing plants must have looked. You know, when it's going, you know, you get up with the light, go to bed when it's dark, you know, they're having to eat everything they've stored and dried because they can't harvest anything. So holly must have been impressed, especially with the berries on. You know, that was fighting nature, it was fine. So lots of Christmas associations. But you have to be very particular. Firstly, women have to take the smooth leaf ones into the house, and the men, the spiky ones, because if a woman takes the spiky one into the house,
they'll be in charge the rest of the next year, which
that sounds quite
the other thing is, it's a very good plan for Christmas, but you have to do it right. You don't take it in before. You don't take it in before Christmas Eve. So Christmas Eve is when you take holly in. Now, I mentioned about the fairies. These are really bad fairies. However, they do like a bit of comfort and they do like a bit of a fireside and everything over the Christmas time. So fairies live with this plant. You take them in on Christmas Eve. You take them in on Christmas Eve. You're taking the fairies in to in your house, who are going to be really grateful for a few crumbs and the heat of the fire and perhaps a bit of slow gin. You never know. But Christmas Eve. But you have to take the holly out on the 12th night, because the fairies then are thinking, we've had enough, we're going to turn bad again. So you've got a very limited, and you don't leave any leaves in. If you left a leaf in, bad luck for the rest of the year. So it's got to be Christmas Eve till 12th night, and be selective which leaves you want to take in. Hollywood is very associated with authority and charms and things, and whip makers use Hollywood to make the handle. And even in the 1940s, a big whip company in Birmingham said their biggest demand for handles was holly. Hazel is used by cattle drovers because that's meant to have really good properties. People driving hearse and stuff can use yew. It's everything that keeps the dead where the dead should be, and the bad spirits where the bad spirits should be, and the good spirits. So the plants, whether it's wood in a wooden bowl, there's things about caraway seeds. Put caraway seeds in your husband's pocket and he won't have an affair. Put caraway seeds in a box with things you are special and you'll never lose them. Whether it's because they smell, so you can follow the smell and you'll find what you want, I don't know. So there's all these little stories about how you just manage your life, you know, and how you make sure whoever you want to love you will love you. There's things about putting cabbage leaves under your hat to keep you cool, which actually is it's no different than having a damp cloth, I suppose, is it? Because it's got a lot of water in it. And so it's, look, some are practical, some are a bit strange, but yeah, remember the holly. Churchyard with a yew tree at the gate. Yeah. Now there are different yews, the English yew, the nice big green one. All parts of the plant are poisonous apart from the red flesh of the berry that isn't. But you know, you have to make sure you don't. The yew.
The yew.
Yeah. So you think all parts are poisonous. You associate them with yew trees, people think often is the Christian adopting paid and special sites, and the yew has got paid and things. People thought that the churchyard was a place of sanctuary, so if you're in a battle or whatever, you can go there and you can make longbows and arrows from the yew. But people did that. We won't have any yew trees left because the world had been chopped down to make things. As I said before, people believe the roots of the yew tree feed into all the graves and it's the spirit of people. Now, in the botanical book, we're looking at some of the planting in Maryhill Car Park on the main sort of avenue when you go down to the glassblower statue. Yeah, that one. And there's Irish and English yew there. Irish yew tends to be more columnar and you can get a golden form. So in National Trust Gardens, a lot of the yews that you see pruned often are Irish because they naturally grow like that, so you've got a lot less work. English yews grow like umbrellas, like really big flake, you know, flailed out. The other way to tell them apart is English yews, the leaves are like a ladder. So you've got a top of the leaf, dark green, and a lighter colour for the underside. Irish yews, they come all the way around the stem. It's more of a cylindrical leaf. So that's an easy way to tell them apart. So if you wanted something that didn't get too big, you wanted a yew tree, but Irish yews will grow a lot more controlled. And the golden yew tends to be an Irish form as well. The other really nice thing, when I came to this churchyard, a couple of things I noticed. Firstly, you're really high up. Secondly, I came and all the glass was on the graves. And that was just amazing. Have you? Oh, around the corner. And then the other thing was all the fruit trees that Barry's been planting, because it is, you've got lots of fruit trees. There's damson trees planted over the back, and there's the big original pear tree here, and then lots of other pear trees planted, which is great, because, you know, somewhere you can come and you can pick things that's good for nature, and we need to get these orchards back dotted around the place. The pear tree, probably one of the most well-known ones, conference pear. Yeah.
In the late 1800s, there was a national pear conference at Chiswick in London. And if you think, you know, you think, oh, that's a bit of a strange thing to have a conference about. You know, fruit trees were significant as part of British economy. There's lots, you know, all the orchards on Evesham and everywhere. But even in the 1500s, there were over 230 varieties of pears recorded. I don't think we've got that, you know, we haven't got that now because it doesn't fit with supermarkets. But at this conference, in the late, I think it was about 1885, the RHS gave awards of merit to plants. You'll see it in garden centres, AGM it's called. It means it's been tested, it's a really good plant. And there was a new seedling of a pear, and the RHS gave it the award of merit because it was so such a good one. And when they thought of what to call it, they called it Conference Pear because it was brought to the National Pear Conference at Chiswick. So that's why it's called Conference Pear. And actually, it's the only thing, there's not many things I don't like to eat, and pear is the only thing I don't. I love pear trees, I've got them in the garden, but I don't like eating them. William Robinson was a really famous garden designer in the 19th century. He did the wild flower and the meandering paths, you know, when everyone was formal. He was really into the flower garden. He said there's only 10 minutes in a pear's life when it's ready to eat. Which I think is probably true, really. I haven't even found those 10 minutes yet, to be honest. Yeah.
Were they planted for any...
It won that, no, well it was at entrances, again it's garden, it's about garden things, so you get date, what they're called with the lich dates, you know, you get lich dates on churches and often people use certain wood, so if you couldn't have the plant at your doorway, you could use the wood. So some things used...
Yeah, because opposite the Arlington Arts Centre,
oh, yeah.
Two.
Yeah, there is actually, isn't there? That's where I drive home, yeah.
Triangle. Yeah. I was wondering if that was very...
Well, it's gateway. It's reason. About spirits and it's about, you know, it's more of a good luck thing and more protection thing. And that's why people think, because the woods was used to make bows, how does our protection come from that pure defence thing? If you've got a yew tree, you've always got a weapon. Yeah. Or is it something further than that? But what's happened with a lot of the stories and a lot of beliefs is they've been adopted through different cultures. So a lot of the Christian ones have been adopted and translated to be less pagan. So the yew tree was very significant. So something that was significant to pagans when Christianity came, you just adopt. You don't fight, do you? You adopt the go with the flow, really, so that gets carried on. Yeah. I mean, one of the most significant trees in Britain is actually the ash tree. That's one of the most sort of, you know, superstitious and magical trees, and that's where you're getting a lot of names, Ashbourne, and all sorts of things. If you look, there's ash in quite a lot of place names, and that's because there will have been an ash tree there and the association with it, so it's a magical. But whether the tree came first and people lived around it and the stories came, lots of ash trees are associated with whooping cough and... rickets and all sorts of things, and you pass children through the boughs of ash trees to cure them. And there's quite a lot that people remember now. So, oh yeah, my grandma said when she was little and she had scarlet fever, whatever, she was passed through. People still attach like messages and prayers to trees, and although we associate with quite a Buddhist thing, it was actually happening in Britain in medieval times. Mm-hmm. People were burying things at tree roots. There's a tree, I can't remember which it is, but there's one that even now when people fell it, they often find a coin at the root, and it's been people have been placing this token at trees' roots and tree surgeons now. And even a tree surgeon, so if you're chopping down a big ash tree, you know to be careful of the nails in the trunk. And if you get a nail on your trunk with a chainsaw, it's really dangerous. That's why people don't want trees chopped down, often put nails in, because it saboteurs the chainsaw people. But people did it because of the ash trees associated with good health, and particularly with children. And people were nailing bits of people's dresses and cloth to bring them the health. And those nails are still in the tree, because the trees can be 300 years old and it's grown over it. So tree surgeons know if you're doing a big ash tree, particularly one that's significant, like on a village green or at the church or something that was actually part, because obviously towns get bigger, but if it's an older one and it's in the original part of the town, then, you know, be careful, because it could have a lot of nails under the bark and it could be that far under and they'll still be there. So,
should local authorities be encouraged to plant more fruit trees?
Yes. Well, I've been doing quite a lot about urban food, and I went on a scholarship last year to Canada and America looking at what they're doing with community gardening. And yeah, I don't think we can solve our food problem by growing it all in cities. But we need to think differently. And if we're going to plant fruit trees, then plan, why not look more? And, you know, there are issues at health and safety in streets. People can, you know.
Forget health and safety.
Yeah, I know. But people complain about people might slip on a pear or there'll be loads of bees. Islington Council, Islington, which has got the least green space in the whole of Britain, have got their leader of the council, Terry, someone's just doing amazing things. And they have a policy now where they're planting trees. You don't get a choice of if you have a tree or not, you just get a choice of what it is. And they have a list of fruit trees, and people are planting fig trees and all sorts, and they're just planting loads of fruit trees. And there's lots of things now about people harvesting harvesting them. So if you've got fruit trees in your garden, you've got too much stuff, like in Sheffield, they've got a group of people who go and harvest it, give you what you want, and then take the rest and sell it for charity, or it goes to homeless, or, you know, Meals on Wheels even. Yeah, yeah. There's a lot about urban foraging, about, you know, telling you what's about and what you can go and collect.
Because there's vast tracts.
Oh yeah, well they're not very big, so actually you can fit them in places you wouldn't normally fit anything else.
Exactly.
And if you want to rely on the new scientific stuff, then we've got such brilliant, you know, things that don't need pollination, you know, cross-pollination, things that don't get too big because they've been grafted on certain rootstocks, so there's room really. And I say the other thing is, one thing we've lost is the seasonality of like respecting. The other thing we've lost is storage and pickling and preserving. So it's always like, oh, I've got too many, and actually there shouldn't be so much of such a thing, should there, because we need that skill of what do you do with it, as well as eat it as an apple. So, and they're the skills that we need to get back. And there's quite a lot happening now to encourage it, and the urban food debate is probably one of the biggest ones we've got. You know, one of the things that I'm looking at is working with architects and planners about, can we look at opportunities to do more vegetables or temporary allotments or...
existing.
There's a lot. There's a lot. I mean, we lost a lot of orchards. In the 1980s, loads of orchards got ripped out, and but Countryside Commission introduced a grant now to look after orchards. A lot are past it because they haven't been maintained, and the commercial viability of some of the old varieties. But yeah, we have got a few left, but loads. They were there until the early 1980s, and then just loads got wiped out because of subsidy, all sorts of issues about if it's economical or not. So, but we'll just end round the corner. A couple of plants that I think, you know, demonstrate how we've got these, you know, how some of these stories were people believe them. One, ferns. If you think about ferns and bracken, I was looking at the bracken growing on the canal as you go towards the Merry Hill place, and it's quite significant for the area because burnt bracken and the potash was used in the glass industry, it's used to make soaps, so it's quite a significant plant. It's very poisonous. In theory, you can eat the young shoots as asparagus if you want to, but they are quite poisonous, so I don't know which 10 days they're edible to eat or whatever, but I wouldn't advise it. But the ferns, you know, there's quite a lot of graves around here with ferns on, and people thought ferns were magical because they couldn't see how they spread. Look at a rose, it's got rose hips, you open it, it's got seeds in it. Look at a fruit, apple, it's got seeds in it. How could ferns spread? And they didn't realise that all the little dots underneath are the spores, the dust, they're so tiny, get into water streams, they blow. So people associated that they must be magical, and they spread secretly, so they were invisible. They had invisible things on the seeds, in effect, are they so small? So people associated fern spores with invisibility. So you have fern spores or fern leaf in your pocket and it makes you invisible. And someone said that they were out and they got lost one night after the pub and trampled through a load of bracken. And when they got back, the family couldn't see them. Anyway, the family were just very annoyed and were ignoring them, probably. But lots of us. It wasn't his house. It might not have been his house. But there's a lovely story that's from Staffordshire. And 1836, the Earl of Pembroke, who was the Lord Chamberlain, so like the King's secretary or something, he actually wrote to the Sheriff of Staffordshire and said, the King's coming through, remember this is 1636, King's coming through on his horse, can you tell everybody in the area along the route, and he told him the route, not to burn bracken and not to walk through ferns or cut ferns because he didn't want it to rain. And they associated again this idea of dust stirring in the air would make it rain. So then this is like, you know, the royal household are like saying, we tell people before we go somewhere, we don't, a bit like the Queen thinking everywhere smells of wet paint, isn't it, or something. The idea is we don't want to go somewhere and it rains, so we just tell everyone before we go there not to touch the ferns because the ferns make it rain. And now, you know, people talk about putting dust in the atmosphere, don't they, to make it rain when you need to, so it's clear the day after for a nice event. And so that was the idea, really, of all the ferns and the fern spore. So there's lots of things that go, if you want to find out more, I mean, obviously, you know, this is the Botanical Library with something, but there's some really good books. There's a Shire publication book called Plant Folklore. There's a lot on the internet. There's a one called Plants for the Future, which has their edible use, their scientific use, it's all referenced, their folklore use and everything. So there's quite a lot of information, but just remember, some of the stories actually have found to be true, and in a way, this folklore is our longest medical trial ever. You know, we only know the stories that work, because someone's tested, you know, they've been tested out. So somewhere along the line, there's logic in it, there's some strangeness in it. I mean, particularly the thing about witches and stuff, I mean, what, you know, it's just that pure superstition of looking after themselves.
But you know, that's how we work now, and that's why it's important to have all the plants. So this year's year biodiversity, and one of the things that Opal, you know, are doing about engaging people in nature to realise what's on your doorstep. Don't think about the rainforest and everything, it's important for here. And if you think about biodiversity, it's about a bit of everything, because we need a bit of everything. Imagine now if you said, what's your favourite food? Right? No, so right, I'm going to have chocolate cake. Right, okay, you can live off chocolate cake for next year. You're going to come in your kitchen, take out everything out of the cupboards that isn't the ingredients of chocolate cake. First, I'd probably say about the first couple of months, I'd probably be all right, actually, but it would be, you wouldn't be healthy, would you? So what if we said to the earth plant, so what if we said, we don't know what we can use this plant for, so it doesn't matter if it dies, it doesn't matter if we build on it, it doesn't matter if there's climate change, it floods, because we can't use it. Then you've reduced your recipe to such a small range of ingredients that when we need those plants, because, you know, corn's getting diseases because we've bred it so much, the bit that kept the disease out was in the wild form that we'd lost. But we got rid of the wild form because we've got a better one, it's got bigger heads on it. You know, so we need, so that's why it's year biodiversity, so it's about everything. And in Britain, there are plants that are going extinct, there are plants we need to conserve, there's plants on the endangered list. So, you know, the idea of the folklore is nice messages, but equally just makes you think people have used plants for all sorts of things, and actually we do. It's just that they happen to be in a tin or in a packet of medicine or... But if you want me to send you one out, I will, as soon as they're hot off the press. So that's it. But what I would like to do is leave the notebook, and if you want... I mean, the guidebooks will be available to pick up.